Welcome back to the program. It was Balzac who said that behind every great fortune is a great crime. For some fortunes, there's more than one. But little did we know that behind every humble banana is a great story, maybe even a great crime, and certainly some great characters. All of this is detailed in a new book by my guest Rich Cohn. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone. He's the author of the previous books Tough Jews and Sweet and Low. It is my pleasure to welcome Rich Cohn back to this program to talk about his newest work, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. Rich Cohn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. One of the things that's remarkable about this story is the sheer scope of it, and yet it's a story that is little known. Talk a little bit about how you came to the story of the Banana King.
Well, I went to school at Tulane University, and which is in New Orleans, and you start to walk in and out of buildings named Zimmerman, and after a while you start to wonder who was Zimmerman. And then the president of Tulane lives in this, I think, the most beautiful house in America, to Audubon Place on St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans. And it's this huge antebellum mansion, and it had been the house of Samuel Zimmerman, America's Banana King. And it's, you walk in there for functions or whatever, and it's just like he left it. It's this house built by a banana baron who took different wood from every country in Central America and built the rooms of this house filled with maps where the banana freighters go. And it's like wandering in one of those old American places, like as you imagine if you walk through, you know, Citizen Kane's house. And I just became completely fascinated by the guy, and the more you learn about him, the more fascinated you become.
And the story really begins for you in some ways in the oddest of places, in Selma, Alabama.
Yeah. Well, not a place you think of sort of this kind of tycoon or certainly a Jewish immigrant from Russia coming, but basically a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the big department stores that were started by Jewish people, they started out with peddlers, guys from often German Jews who carried everything they could on their back from farm to farm and sold it. And when they got older and got a little more money, they opened stores. And those became the great department stores, and in some cases became the great investment banks, like Lehman Brothers. That's how Lehman Brothers started. And one of these guys was related to Sam Zimmerman, who was his uncle. Sam Zimmerman, when he was 14, he lived on a wheat farm in Bessarabia, Russia. His father died, and they sent him to America to make money to bring his siblings over, a very typical thing. And he ended up in Selma to work at his uncle's store, the place where he had a relative. And while working in this dry goods store, he saw his first banana, which is sort of like, in a way, the story is a love story between a man and a banana, and that's the moment that they meet. And if you grew up on a wheat farm in Western Russia where things are supposed to come out of the ground but never do, and you see a banana, it's like a miracle, and it changed his whole life.
And bananas at the time were this really exotic thing.
I know it's hard to imagine, but the fact that bananas being everywhere and being in the street and people slipping on banana peels and pretending banana peels are telephones, that was all a strategy by United Fruit. Bananas had been, I think the first time anybody really saw them in the United States was at the Philadelphia Exposition in the 1870s, where they were being sold by the slice. That's how rare they were. Mm-hmm. And because basically, until you had steam power and then refrigerated ships, you couldn't have a commercial banana trade because the fruit would rot in the process. And United Fruit, before Zimmerman, to make a banana the thing for the masses. And one of the amazing things that they did was they put a company agent at South Ferry in New York to meet the ferries coming in from Ellis Island with the new immigrants. And they would give each immigrant a banana and say, "Welcome to America." And that forever would associate with these people, the banana with America. And the joke was, of course, the bananas were as much imports as the people coming off the ships. Not one of them was grown here.
And it was precisely this idea that they didn't stay ripe long, that they would rot, that really gave Zimmerman his start.
Yeah, he went down, after he saw that first banana, he went down to Mobile, Alabama, where he heard the big fruit ships came in from the Caribbean with these bananas. And he sat there all one day just watching them unload the ships. And what he noticed was one group of bananas went in one set of trains, and another group on another set of trains, and a third group of bananas were just thrown in a big pile. And they were the yellow bananas, the ones you'd normally eat. And he went up and he asked the company agent who was handling the bananas what those were. And he said, "Those were the ripes." And he said, "What's a ripe?" He said, "Basically, ripes are bananas that are too far along to make it to the market in time. They'll be rotten by the time you get them into the store. And he asked what they did with them, and he said they threw him into the sea. They were garbage. And basically, he spotted this niche. He basically thought he could hustle enough to get this stuff to market in time, and for very little money, because they were otherwise throwing it out, he bought great amount of these ripe bananas, which everyone else considered garbage. To me, it's fascinating because it's the immigrant sensibility. You know, it's like one man's trash is another man's treasure.
It's the immigrant sensibility, and also, as you say, what makes a better salesman than selling a product that's going to perish in 48 hours?
That's right. It's like having a guillotine over your head. I mean, you have to sell it in 2 days or you're done. And it turned him, Sam Zemuri, into one of the greatest salesmen this country's probably ever known.
And talk about the way he did this out of these boxcars wiring ahead to the grocers who would meet the train.
Well, he started out conventionally, which is he was going to rent space on the Illinois Central train, and he was going to, you know, bring the bananas home to Selma and sell them in the market. But he started to realize what the big companies knew, which is they were going to rot. The trains were very, very slow, and he was panicking, and he came up with sort of an audible, like a plan B, which is he worked out a deal with the telegraph operators to wire ahead. He'd give them a split of the proceeds. If they contacted all the fruit peddlers and all the grocery store guys, and they came right out and met the train, and they bought the bananas for very cheap right off the train, and that became his business. And basically, the New York Times then said that this guy was using boxcars as if they were push carts. And it was incredible because, think about it, this guy's selling garbage, basically what other people considered garbage. By the time he was 18 selling that garbage, he had made $100,000. This is in the 1890s when that would be the equivalent of probably $10 million. And he came to the attention of the big banana companies because he was a legendary guy. He was this 6'3", Russian, Jewish, Alabaman guy selling the brown bananas and making a fortune. And from then his career was launched.
And how did the traditional fruit distributors feel about him undercutting them?
Well, at first, you know, it's sort of like it was good. They were selling stuff that they had been throwing out. And United Fruit actually has signed a contract with them, which I've seen. It's a really funny contract because it defines a ripe as one freckle, it's a turning, and two freckles, it becomes a ripe. And as soon as it becomes a ripe, it belongs to Sam Zemuri. Think about that. Everything in the world is slowly becoming his. You know, you wait long enough, it turns into yours. And, you know, it was kind of too late before they realized that they empowered this incredible competitor. But at first, they saw him as this kind of eccentric fruit peddler, and they always kind of looked down on him because he was Jewish, because he was Russian, because he was uneducated. And Boston Fruit was an old, waspy, Brahmin company on Federal Street. And by the time they realized that this guy was more than just a simple little fruit peddler, it was sort of too late, and they had let into the market, if you will, the guy that was going to devour them, that was the fish that ate the whale, United Fruit being the whale.
And one of the things that you talk about in this aspect of the story continues in almost everything Sam Zemuri does, which is that it's always sort of a simple, fundamental idea that he's able to capitalize on.
Yeah, it's great. It's like he sees things simply. He had a saying, which is, don't be smarter than a problem. You know, in a weird way, it's a business story and a business book, and you can take lessons from it. So, you know, simply, it was a matter of time, beating time. One of the great stories about him that, to me, exemplifies everything he was about was when he was battling with United Fruit, they were both going after the same piece of land, which was between the border of Guatemala and Honduras to grow bananas on. They both did studies and found out that the land had two legal owners. And United Fruit did what big companies do, which is they hired a bunch of lawyers and investigators to try to figure out who the real owner was and buy it from that person. And meanwhile, Zemuri just went to both and bought it twice. And that was the way he operated. It was, you know, why not just solve this thing? And another amazing thing about him is that he lived in the jungle. He lived in Honduras in a hut in the jungle. He cleared his own fields with his workers. He spoke Spanish. He was kind of a rough guy, like a cowboy. And at that point, when he started, Honduras was still, it was called the banana frontier. It was seen as the last vestige of the American frontier, and it's the last place you get sort of the American frontier idea for good and for very bad, which is the sort of colonial aspect of moving into someone else's country. But it just made him this sort of legendary and ultimately feared person who really became one of the most powerful people in the country.
And part of the idea of moving down there was not for the drama of it, but because he was a hands-on guy. He believed that if he was going to do this, he had to be there.
Yeah, he used to say to the guys at United Fruit, he said, "You don't know what you're talking about." And they were in Boston. He would say, "You're there, I'm here." And that was his thing. If you actually went on the ground and figured out what was going on, you couldn't lose. And during the Great Depression, when the banana business was in trouble, he kind of saved United Fruit. The company itself had hired, again, they hired academics. They did reports to try to figure out what was wrong with their business. Sam Zemurray, unlike them, went to the docks in New Orleans and spoke to the stevedores and spoke to the banana captains and asked them what was wrong and got the answers. And that was always his strategy, which was trust the people on the ground and trust the people who know. And if you think about it, I mean, if you want to think of an analogy today, what's so amazing about the guy, it would be like a guy taking a job pumping gas at an Exxon station on the highway, and 25 years later he owns ExxonMobil. That's what he did.
Right. The story, before it gets to Honduras, runs through Costa Rica. Talk about that part of the story.
Well, in Costa Rica, a guy was hired to make the first intercontinental railroad in the Western Hemisphere. We think of it as our railroad from the East Coast to the West Coast. In fact, it was across the Isthmus. And for a various set of reasons, a guy was hired who didn't know how to build railroads, because he looked at a map and it looked very easy. It was short. It was 54 miles. How hard is it to lay 54 miles of railroad? He sent for his little brother named Minor Keith to help him. And the railroad, which was going to be so easy, took like 25 years to build because it was right across the jungle. In the first 20 miles of track, 2,000 people died. I think maybe 4,000 people died altogether, including all of the guy who started the railroad and two of his brothers. And the only survivor was Minor Keith. And after they built the railroad, was making no money, he started planting bananas in the right-of-way along the railroad tracks, which was basically cleared a tunnel through the jungle. There was maybe 200 yards on each side of the train, and they just planted banana stems there, and they just exploded. And that became the money. So United Fruit started really as a railroad company, and they grew bananas as a sideline, and the bananas became the most profitable thing. And Minor Keith is this amazing guy himself who ended up owning Isla in Long Island, New York, and being one of the richest guys in the country. And he just started by planting these railroads, these bananas and sidings. But what's interesting is, you know, all his brothers died, and there was all this death surrounding him. And that was really the beginning of the banana business being a big business instead of just a little business where you're buying bananas by the slice.
And as this business expands in Honduras, essentially Zemurray almost becomes the ruler of the country. If he doesn't like one government there, he gets rid of it.
I think of Zemurray as a story of sort of three coup d'etats. The first one was he went down to Honduras to buy his own land. Vertical integration was the way they did the business. They wanted to control everything for good, sound business reasons, which is you had to control your supply to control the price. And he went down to Honduras and he bought a lot of land very cheaply because it was virgin jungle that people always just considered diseased and worthless. And he started to clear the land, and he started to do what all the banana companies did, which is bribe local officials so he didn't have to pay import tax or export tax. The bananas were sold so cheap you basically couldn't pay tax or you'd fail. So he ran around and he bribed all these people, and he was all set up to do business. And the U.S. government came in with J.P. Morgan, the banker, not the banker himself, the old man, and they were going to basically take over Honduras because Honduras had this dangerous debt, sort of reminiscent of what's going on right now with Greece, very similar. And they were afraid that Honduras was going to collapse. And they were going to take over Honduras and sit J.P. Morgan bank officers in the customs houses and collect tax on everything. And that would mean Zemurray would have to pay tax, which would make his bananas more expensive than United Fruit, and that would be it. So he met with the Secretary of State, which is kind of crazy, because he'd just been in the country like 15 years, and he pled his case, and the Secretary of State didn't care, but was nervous enough about him that he sent a group of Secret Service agents to New Orleans, where Zemurray was now living, to make sure Zemurray didn't go to Honduras, didn't leave New Orleans, nor any of his cohorts. So now a normal person would just sort of go to plan B or try to figure out some way to sell with the land they bought or something. Zemurray was kind of crazy. And instead of doing that, he went down to the Hotel Monteleone on Royal Street in the French Quarter, and he hired the most famous mercenary in America, a guy right out of a Wild West movie named Lee Christmas. And with Lee Christmas, they went and they found this guy, Manuel Bonilla, who was living in a cold water flat near the Mississippi River. And he was the deposed president of Honduras. And they went around and they hired a mercenary army. All these mercenaries hung out in New Orleans at the time. And they got in, Zamora bought him an old Spanish warship, an old warship used in the Spanish-American War. And he snuck them out past those Secret Service agents through Storyville, which was a tenderloin, out through the bayous, and out into the Gulf of Mexico. And they went down to Honduras and they attacked the country. And with like 100 guys, they eventually warred with and overthrew the government of Honduras. And Zamora put Manuel Bonilla in power, and Manuel Bonilla's first executive order was that Samuel Zamora does not pay tax in Honduras for 25 years.
The other part of the story of Zamora is that he did this, you know, out of his back pocket. He never had an office, never had assistants. It was always on the fly.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's a, the historian writes, I read a quote by a historian who said that in 1954, maybe, I forget, it was about a coup where the CIA with the U.S. Army overthrew a government and said, of course, this took hundreds and hundreds of people and millions of dollars, but Sam Zamora, the Banana King, did it in Honduras by himself with nothing. And it's just, to me, he was a great poker player. And in his business life, you see in him the great poker player. Whenever, you know, it was a moment to put everything in the table, he pushed all his chips back in and he bet again. And that's just how he lived. And, of course, he did that and did that and did that until he lost, which is, you know, the end of his life. But that's what happens, you know, with gamblers, is they'll play until they lose.
Talk a little bit about the broader influence that he had in Central America, you know, hence the whole idea of banana republics.
Well, it's interesting. The term banana republic actually comes from Honduras. It was, there was no extradition treaty to the United States with Honduras, so it became a refuge of criminals. And one of them was a guy who'd taken off from a bank in Austin, Texas with thousands and thousands of dollars, a teller. He hung out in the dives along Primera Street in Puerto Cortez, Honduras, soaking up the scene, and then eventually wrote a book of stories about it. And that guy needed a pen name, and it was O. Henry. And his book was, first book was called Cabbages and Kings. And in the beginning of that book, he first uses the term banana republic. And what happened in those countries is the banana companies, and then specifically United Fruit, which Zamora would ultimately control, became so powerful that they were more powerful than the government. So in Guatemala, United Fruit ultimately owned 70% of the private land. It paid most of the taxes. In Guatemala, they owned the Pacific ports. That means if the government did something they didn't like, they could shut down the ports. They delivered the mail. They could shut down the mail. They were the most powerful agents in those countries. And, of course, this created tremendous hostility and a huge backlash. So, you know, in a way, that backlash personified would later be Fidel Castro. So in a weird way, you go straight from Fidel Castro, whose father worked for United Fruit, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So you go straight from, there's a line that could be drawn from Sam Zamora with his ripes to Fidel Castro still sitting in Cuba today.
Talk a little bit about the enemies that Zamora had here in the U.S., including Huey Long.
Well, his big enemy, you know, he was a New Orleans figure, Zamora. So he started in Selma, he moved to Mobile where the bananas came in, but then when he got big, he moved to New Orleans. New Orleans now has had a real rough time, and we think of it as kind of a tourist town and a Mardi Gras town. But this is a time when New Orleans was one of the biggest ports in the country. It was before Houston boomed and all this. And New Orleans was a key city, and Zamora was sort of the king of that city. And then Huey Long came in, and Huey Long's whole thing was to destroy the system now and to basically give the money away. And it's interesting because Huey Long was a Democrat and Zamora was a Democrat. And Zamora was a big supporter of the New Deal and a close advisor to Franklin Roosevelt. But there was a feeling that Long was going to run against Roosevelt. And this was like a lot of fear that he was going to cost Roosevelt the election. And Zamora became a big opponent of Long in those years. And they were battling each other. And Long, who was paranoid but did have enemies, like the saying goes, he was correctly paranoid, believed that Zamora, knowing the history of Honduras and what had happened there, that Zemuri was going to overthrow him in a military-style coup like he'd done in Honduras and replace Long as governor of Louisiana with a hand-picked guy, specifically the mayor of New Orleans, just like he'd done in Honduras. And in fact, one of Zemuri's key allies, a mercenary soldier named Machine Gun Maloney, had become the chief of the New Orleans police at one point, and he was convinced, Long, that Machine Gun Maloney was in New Orleans to overthrow him. And that became, you know, Huey Long is one of the most storied figures in American history. Only gave one speech about foreign policy in his entire political career, and that was to denounce Sam Zemuri.
Zemuri also got very involved in the Zionist effort. Talk about that.
Well, it's interesting because he was Jewish, but being Jewish didn't seem especially important to him. Both his children were married in church. They both became Christians. He went to synagogue. He did sort of, you know, the minimum you can do. You go to high holidays, whatever. But early on in his life, when he first really started to make money, he received a visit from Chaim Weizmann. Weizmann would become the first president of Israel. He's really the guy who got the British to pass, or whatever verb you use, the Balfour Declaration, and which created the whole basis for Israel. And it's unclear to me how much he really cared, you know, about Israel becoming a state, about there being a Jewish nation, or how much of it was a personal relationship with Weizmann. But early on, even in the 1920s, he gave a lot of money to Zionists in Palestine to do things like build power plants and buy seed to plant farms. And then later on, he became involved in all kinds of efforts through really the instigation of Weizmann. So he helped get Jews out of Europe in the 1930s. That, I think, he felt a strong identification because he came from the part of Europe where really it was the worst. I mean, there was no good part of Europe, but Western Russia was just a killing field. And I really think he had a sense of his own narrow escape from there. And then later on, after the Second World War, there was, you know, people don't remember, but after the Holocaust, there were 1 million Jews living in DP camps. Basically, they were refugees. They had survived, but no country wanted them. And they were living in former concentration camps. And there was a Zionist effort to smuggle those people out of those camps and bring them to Palestine. And to do that, they'd have to run a British blockade. British were controlling Palestine. And when the people came to America to get ships and to figure out how to do it, one of the first people they went to see was Zemuri. Because by then, Zemuri controlled United Fruit, and United Fruit had the largest private navy in the world. And Zemuri couldn't give them ships, but he could tell them what to do. He could tell them where to get ships, how to operate, how to flag ships, and how to smuggle people around. That's what United Fruit had always done when being involved in civil wars in foreign countries. And then later, crucially, when there was a vote at the UN about whether or not Palestine should be partitioned into two countries, one for Jews, one for Arabs, you needed a two-thirds vote to carry it. There was a vote, it fell, it lost, but it was such a close vote that they scheduled a second vote 3 days later. And Weizmann came to Zemuri and said, "We need you now more than ever." And Zemuri basically got on the phone from his house in New Orleans. And if you look at the final vote, why it passed, you look at which countries switched their votes between those two. And they happened, the countries that either switched from no to abstain or from abstain to yes. And they're all countries where bananas completely dominate the market. They're banana republics where one country and one person had the most influence, and that was Sam Zemuri.
And what led to Zemuri's undoing? What were the risks he took at the end?
Well, like I say, he got old, you know, and he got old. But, and also in the Second World War, his son died. He had a son, Sam Zemuri Jr., who was this kind of, I always think of him as the biggest thing Sam Zemuri grew in America. He was 6'5", two-lane football player, captain of the boxing team, and he was a pilot. He was a major in the Army Air Force, and he was one of the first American casualties in the Second World War. And he was never really Zemuri was never really the same after that. I said that it's a story of three coups. First, Honduras put him in the game, but then in the 1950s, after the war, there was a democratic movement in Guatemala, which ultimately brought Jacobo Arbenz to the presidency of Guatemala. And his big issue was United Fruit. And he thought United Fruit had too much land and too much power, and he began to nationalize United Fruit's holdings. And Sam Zemurray, working with Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and the man considered to be the father of public relations, he invented the word public relations, and a bunch of other political players like Tommy the Cork Corcoran and Bob La Follette and all these people, basically sold to America and to the CIA this idea that Guatemala had gone communist and represented a threat in the Western Hemisphere. The end result of that was another coup, the third coup, with the CIA overthrowing the elected government of Guatemala and the new government giving United Fruit back all its holdings that had been nationalized. But it was so blatant, and it was so over the top what had happened. And Arbenz went down just saying, basically, United Fruit, United Fruit, United Fruit, that finally, after the war, reporters and people in the public started to notice, and they started to say, what is going on? I mean, did we do this for United Fruit or for the United States? And it was kind of not dissimilar from the Iraq War in some ways with Halliburton and all the questions that were being asked, because a lot of the people that worked for United Fruit had either also worked for the U.S. government, and the ties were really crazy. Like, the first head of the CIA was the president of United Fruit, Beadle Smith. The second head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, had worked for United Fruit on the Guatemala contract. And the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, had also worked for a law firm called Sullivan Cromwell on the contracts between United Fruit and Guatemala. So basically, the scrutiny became so intense, and then the Justice Department, claiming it was a coincidence, but it's hard to believe, 1 week after the overthrow of Arbenz, filed a massive antitrust lawsuit against United Fruit, at the end of which the company was forced to sell off many of its holdings, which they sold to the company that was Del Monte, and that was really the end of United Fruit. Zemurray lived another, 10 years. He died in 1961, but that was really the beginning of the end.
Rich Cohen, the book is The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. Rich, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks. Always excellent to talk to you.
Thank you.